The lecture number 4 focuses on Brenda architectures and a case for a house of brands, and also discusses the rationale of diversifying one's brand portfolio. On slide number 3, I'm having a little bit eclectic photo of the brand portfolio of Marsh Corporation. It's for a good reason why they don't market together all these products under one umbrella brand or corporate brand. They are leaders in globally in dog and cat food, but also they are having prominent business in rice and all kinds of sauces, as well as in snacks and candy and chocolate bars. So in a way, most probably the idea they have had quite reasonably that it's better to sell cat and dog food separately especially for these indulgement products that are targeted for human beings. On slide number 4, we have a little bit different take on building a brand portfolio. Nestle, one of the global giants in fast-moving consumer goods, they're actually not as shy about their corporate brand compared to for example, the Marsh Corporation. They are if you look at some of the leading products, they are always bringing part of the Nestle brand into it. In coffee, they have Nescafe and Nespresso, both indicating where the family is coming from. In chocolate, they have a number of products that indicate quite directly that it is part of the Nestle family. For example, Nesquik, the hot chocolate cocoa powder. And the same line is very much visible across the portfolio. So for Nestle, in a way, it's a hybrid. It's a house of brands, but also the corporate brand of Nestle is endorsing many of the brands in a manner that maybe even some consumers don't actively realize, but still it's there supporting, and that's most visible in the coffee portfolio. The slide number 5 illustrates a different approach, where actually the Unilever, one of the Nestle's main rivals and benchmarks, again, one of the global powerhouses in fast-moving consumer goods, is fully focusing on having very independent product brands. And sometimes these brands can stand for very different things. I think, in a way, one of the most interesting contradictions is that how, for example, the Dove, that is focused on the women's self-esteem, that everyone is beautiful, that everyone is beautiful as they are, contradicts with how they're communicating, for example, the male-orientated and male-targeted deodorant brand Axe, where actually the whole point of selling is that, in a way, using Axe makes you more attractive and helps you to better position yourself in the cruel market of acquaintances and relationships and so on. So in a way, one of the brands communicates for understanding, self-esteem and approval, and the second brand, Axe, communicates for something completely opposite, that it's a beauty contest, what matters in their life, and it's very much male dominated. So in a way, like sometimes in order to live with this kind of contradiction and complexity, you definitely need to pretty much hide your own corporate brand. And I think that is the case for Unilever, and it seems to work well for them. Having an house of brands approach, as we can see on slide number 6, it is more expensive if you look at the total marketing communications and branding expenditure. But at the same time, there are a number of benefits. It helps each brand to position very precisely so that they are not competing amongst themselves, and they can actually take even extreme positions, as indicated previously in the case of Dove and Axe. also it helps to eliminate cross-category conflicts. So sometimes, you know, like pet and cat food and humans chocolate bars are just not compatible. Also, it helps to divest or acquire brands. This is something we see oftentimes in the food and beverage and also in the pharmaceutical business. When the products are stronger than the parent brand, it's easier to buy and sell depending on how your strategy looks like in certain categories. At the same time, having a house of brands approach is sometimes a tool for managing risk in terms of your corporate image. It even if one of the brands or one of the products is involved in a scandal, the corporate brand may remain pretty untarnished. Also, what we are seeing, for example, in the car manufacturing business, having a house of brand approach helps you to have multiple competing brands. Being part of the same family, Tata, for the lower income, middle income people in emerging markets, Jaguar, again, for the high income customers in developed markets, and Land Rover being for those people who feel that they are more independent and somehow, you know, down to earth, but want to have premium. You know, like building a portfolio like that would be completely impossible with one very visible corporate brand. At the same time, even more extreme example is actually coming from the world of champagne. Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, one of the global luxury powerhouses, they have loads of champagne brands, and each of every one of them has been very precisely positioned. So they have Moët Chandon, that stands for one thing, and it's very much related to fashion. Dom Pérignon, that is related to traditional luxury. Krug, that is more about ultimate luxury. And Verville Clicquot, that is, for example, related to in a way like empowering women, and it's over the past years very much targeted to women, and this is only a part of their champagne portfolio. Sometimes you need this kind of house of brand approach in order to make possible to fight in a very price intensive competition where the price sensitivity is very high. You may not want to compromise the pricing power of your top brand, but you still want to be part of the market for each and every customer. And that is a topic we are going to discuss soon. Sometimes a reason for having a house of brands is to just simply avoid channel conflicts. You can sell one brand through one channel and on your second brand through a different channel. And so, in a way, none of them feels somehow frightened or challenged or anything, because in a way, like, it's a different product, it's a different brand, it's a different positioning. And finally, the last point that builds a rationale of house of brands is that you can use brands to signal novelty. Sometimes if you have a very established brand, you have difficulties in introducing novelty products. So that might be one of the causes for launching a whole different brand. And I think we have seen past of successful and not so successful efforts in doing this, especially in the digital business and digital goods and electronics. Slide 7 is a good way to look at how companies make these decisions. One of the global powerhouses in functional, oftentimes business-to-business brands, the 3M, that has an iconic history in being an innovator in product design. This is a decision-making map that they are using when making decisions, when to launch an independent brand, when to tap into the parent brand, when to tap into one of the product line brands. And in a way, in a big portfolio, this is as mechanical and architectural you need to make it for sure. Slide number 8 illustrates an example that is very familiar for me, and I think this was already discussed in one of the benchmarks during the course. Marriott Corporation, that has number of hotels, and this is not quite up to date, to be honest. For super luxury, they have Ritz-Carlton, and they haven't been even trying to incorporate it as part of the Marriott family. Marriott brand, as such, is very much non-visible. When they have high-end hotels, the normal luxury hotels, they are using JW Marriott, that is, whose name comes from the founder of the whole Marriott Corporation and Renaissance brand. When it's quality destination hotels, you know, like good value for money, good location in the destination you need to go, they are using the Marriott main brand and Courtyard by Marriott brands. And then they have extended stay brands for people who need to stay weeks or even months. And at the low end, they have the so-called value hotels brands, Fairville Field, that is, you know, like promising a good price quality ratio, no frills, no extra costs, easy in and out. And what makes this portfolio even more complicated is that nowadays they have the Bulgari luxury hotels side by side to Ritz-Carlton. They have novel design hotel concepts, and after the acquisition that happened last year, they are actually also having the portfolio of Starwood hotels, where they are having a number of, you know, like brands that in a way like are positioning side by side to their current brands. So at the moment they are actually having more than 30 brands, I think, in total, and that is a challenge, and most probably in the future years we are going to see some more of rationalization. The Marriott story continues on slide number 9, where we have a more current take on the original Marriott portfolio. This doesn't include yet the whole scope after the acquisition of a rival hotel giant. Starting from slide 10, we are starting to look at endorsed brands and how, in a way, like we have to sometimes make these mixed choices within our portfolio. As already discussed, Nestle, the global fast-moving consumer goods giant, is using the Nestle, or, you know, like at least the first three letters of the brand name, quite flexibly when branding and embracing new products. And we are seeing a number of approaches to the endorsement. Token endorser is something that you know that is there, but you don't really and don't need to have it visible. For example, Lexus, most people know it's by Toyota, but Toyota is not visible. Linked name, Nestle, Nespresso, Nestia, Nescafe, Nesquik, Nestle. It's the whole Nespresso family is, in a way, a great example of linked name. Strong endorser is a case where the parent brand is very much visible and in a way giving you a guarantee and a warranty that the product is good. For example, the Marriott is using Marriott brand when embracing the lower end chains and concepts very effectively. And at the same time, which is interesting to me, they don't use it as actively when promoting the higher end concepts. So they see that Marriott brands gives value to the lower end mid-tier concepts or low-end concepts, but they don't want to even, in a way, like visibly connect with it when speaking with the higher end clientele of Ritz-Carlton and Bulgari and so on. One way to manage this kind of visible endorsement is to build a sub-brand strategy. I think Aalto University is a great example of that. We have different approaches to communicate what happens at the university level, at the school level, and at the level of the separate institutions, like for Aalto University Executive Education. Citigroup, one of the leading global banking and finance groups, is actually also, in a way, making it clear that this is a different concept, but also at the same time, they very much communicate their city offering and city concept and values and brand at the same time. On slide 13, we can see some very generic approaches how brands could possibly grow. Sometimes if you're having existing brands and existing products, it's more about line extension, new variations of the existing offerings, new flavors, new fragrances, new shapes and sizes. At the other extreme, we have new brand, new products. That's more of a startup or corporate startup and corporate entrepreneurship approach. Sometimes you have an existing products but a new brand. Oftentimes that is about fighter or flanker brands, but you can also see higher end approaches as discussed in the case of Toyota and Lexus. Sometimes you can use your existing brand for new products. You remember the example of Mars chocolate business growing beyond chocolate and entering the ice cream business. A whole different category, different cases for use, partially different consumers, but they decided to use their existing brand when launching a new product, and that has turned into a very successful strategy. Starting from slide 14, we are focusing on fighter and flanker brands that have a role of their own to play in a big portfolio of brands, and there are always a specific rationale for launching one. So flanker brand strategy is more about adding a new brand to the high end or the low end of the category based on the price quality continuum. Sometimes, you know, you don't want to leave any money on the table, and you think that your brand can effectively, or your company can more effectively, in a way, tap into different target groups. Fighting brand strategy or fighter brand strategy, it's all about adding a new brand whose sole purpose is to confront a competitive challenge in order to defend the overall position of the corporation. For example, in the airline business, we see some of the national carriers who want to defend their brand and pricing power, launching daughter companies and sub-brands that are targeted to the more price-sensitive and oftentimes younger clientele. Oftentimes where the need for a launch of a fighter brand comes from is when you face a market situation where you are competing against three. Very few companies are prepared for that. And I think the illustration on slide number 16 is actually quite effective in showing us, in a way, like what are the considerations. What is the growth rate of the category, and what is the defection rate of your current client base? If the category is not growing and the customers are loyal, it's a minor threat. And it's better to simply to keep on watching and monitoring the situation. The other extreme is that when the defection rate is very high, 5% or more every year, and the category is growing very fast, then it might be a case for changing business model. And that is where actually sometimes the filter brands are good tools, because you can test different approaches by using them without compromising the value and the position of the leading brand you own. The defection rate is high, but the growth rate in the category is low. You better introduce so-called free offering, the free product, as soon as possible, you know, like making it as an entry-level product into your portfolio. Oftentimes this is where you're also using your current parent brand, or you may use a whole different brand. Is it a house of brands or a branded house? It's up to you, up to the category, and up to the local marketplace, how the tradition has been. Sometimes you can see a case where, and this is a very positive case, where the growth rate of the category or the marketplace is very high, more than 40%, but at the same time the defection rate is low. Here you can keep on growing with your existing brands and offerings and pricing policies, but at the same time you may leave some of the target groups outside and they are going for other vendors. So if you want to defend your positioning, you better start thinking about moving to house of brands approach, where you have different brands and business models for different clients, so that you may have a free product and a premium product side by side under one umbrella. It's always very much dependent on the market. Do you want to make the collaboration between the brands visible? And sometimes the best approach is to just simply coexist or delay. In a way, like not doing anything. The market is growing, it's growing for you, even if some other players are growing faster. If your profitability is high enough, this might be actually an ideal position to be. So I think in a way, then slide number 16 summarizes it very well. What is the rationale of reconsidering your brand portfolio and considering fighter or flanker brands? When moving forward, I think in a way we need to look at, and as is indicated on slide 17, how to compete against free. Sometimes we can upsell that the starting point price is low, but we are having tools to incentivize the customers to buy additional products or a premium level service. They still remember that the original service was for free, or at least for a very low price. Sometimes cross-selling helps. Ryanair is selling very cheap flight tickets, but at the same time, water, sandwiches, newspapers, anything, luggage, costs quite a bit of extra. Sometimes you can build a business model where actually your offering is free to the users, but expensive and payable for the other things, like advertisers. This is the model that Google is using. Sometimes bundling helps, that you give free or very low-cost offerings to the client, as long as they are combined with higher-end and higher-cost offerings. So in a way, these are some of the coping strategies we need to keep in mind. On slides from 18 to 21, you can find more in detail explanations and approaches of these strategies, how to compete against free. I think slide number 22 explains it quite well, what is the overall agenda for any executive or business decision maker before making any moves. First of all, is your rival, that is a low cost or freemium rival, so weak that you can wait for it to self-destruct, that the funding stops and there is no money left and the whole startup is destabilized and taken down? And we are seeing that oftentimes every month, even in quite famous cases. Or is it better to expect that the rival is there to stay, and then introduce a fighter brand or product? Sometimes it is better to enable and actually even ignite self-cannibalization, where your own offerings and brands and concepts are competing amongst themselves. Sometimes self-cannibalization can be an effective tool for avoiding new rivals entering the whole market. If the market seems busy and crowded, that's one of the famous entry barriers for new players. Sometimes we need to understand that the current management accounting principles are not supporting this kind of approach. Some of the brands build your customer base and some of them make money. If you're focusing on them with this kind of one-by-one approach, that where everything is only a profit center, you may miss this opportunity. And in order to effectively manage the portfolio, the profit and loss responsibility should be at very high levels of the organization, where siloing or infighting shouldn't be an issue, but where the common good and the good for the whole corporation is being considered. And at the same time, the revenue stream, building cash flows and managing costs should be very much controlled at lower levels, at the levels of middle management. Finally, last few words about fighter brands. On slide 23, we see one famous couple. 3M introduced Post-it. It's one of the landmark innovations, and it has been a teaching case for all of us in academia, also for how product innovation may happen, even when you face that your original product is not succeeding. They've been able to sell the Post-it notes at premium prices in different colors in relatively glamorous packaging. And then they realized that there are new players coming to the market. The original innovation is that not that unique, so that actually in a way like it could be easily be defended. So instead of just trying to simplify it and communicate their premium quality, they decided that they are going to launch the Highland brand. And if you look at these two packages together, the Post-it by 3M and the Highland, you can see significant differences in the packaging and how in a way like exclusive it is, how premium does it look like. Also, how is the different in terms of colors of the Post-it notes? It's one of the more energizing and in a way luxurious, and one of them is a little bit lame. And we can only imagine if there might be any differences also in terms of the quality of the glue that Post-it notes may stay longer on your whiteboard compared to the Highland notes. So I think finally slide number 24 summarizes quite well that the key questions you need to ask yourself before launching a fighter brand. Will it cannibalize your premium offering? Is it going to eat your own cash flows and cannibalize your own revenue streams and profits more than those of your rivals? I think that is one of the most fundamental questions. If it does more harm to your rivals than to you, then actually a fighter brand is a very good option. Is it an effective tool to hide away the competition? For example, the airline industry, some of the airlines, the budget airlines founded by the incumbents, the national carriers, haven't been very successful in really getting rid of the low-cost airline, budget airline competition, because eventually the price point was still slightly higher and oftentimes the service was not comparable. How much money are you ready to lose? Oftentimes it takes an investment of multiple years. And is it credible with the customers finally? Are the customers able to in a way like take it? And how much do you want to embrace it in terms of building the links with your parent brand? Is it going to be completely independent? Can you hide the connection? Is there any risk of having discussions that actually, if this is just as good as the original product, why should I pay extra? So in a way, like, how do the final end customers react? And finally, how effectively can your current management team manage two very different business models and revenue models and positionings? Is it consuming too much attention, energy and time? That might be something that turns risky. This is the closing of the lecture and of four, and I hope that you're able to use these concepts in your final exam and assignment.